The Big Story from the Straits Times on Money FM 89.3.
What do we know about Singapore's newest COVID-19 cluster? It's linked to a man who was probably reinfected in India. I'm Olivia Kui.
And I'm Harian Tudiman. You can subscribe to the Straits Times channel so you never miss a single episode.
The Health Ministry reported a new COVID-19 cluster involving an Indian national who had been discharged.
The man had been deemed as no longer infectious then, but MOH found he had later infected his sister-in-law and her husband.
Recapping the sequence of events, the 43-year-old man is here on a work pass and was classified as an imported case when he tested positive on April the 2nd. MOH said he was hospitalized, where authorities found that he had a low viral load and the presence of antibodies based on a positive serology test result on April the 4th.
Plus, his pre-departure test, taken on March 31st, had also came back negative. So he was discharged on April 6th without being required to isolate, as he was deemed to be no longer infectious. But then on April 17th, the man was identified as a close contact of his sister-in-law and subsequently tested positive.
We're now joined by Associate Professor Alex Cook, Vice Dean of Research at the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health. Prof, based on what we know about this case, should MOH reassess how they discharge patients?
Well, the test that we use to confirm whether an infection happens or not is usually the swab followed by a PCR test. The problem with this test is that a positive swab result can mean one of two things. It could mean that the patient is an active case, that they're currently infectious, or it could mean that they recently recovered in the last few weeks or maybe the last month or so. And we cannot tell just from the PCR test alone which one of these two scenarios it is. And that's important for infection control because it determines whether we're going to ward the patient or whether we can send them home. So what we do is we tend to have the second test, the serology test. That's looking for not for a virus in the blood, but it's looking for antibodies to see whether you've been infected in the past or not. Now, if you are positive on the serology test, that would usually mean that you're infected at least 2 weeks ago, or maybe more than that. So for the index case for this cluster, this was someone who was PCR positive, was also serology positive. Now, the PCR test was quite a low viral load, but they were still positive on PCR and then positive on serology. Now, the assumption would be that with that, that is probably not an active infection. It was an old infection. That would have determined what happened to the patient after being released. Now, the problem is that now we're starting to see reinfection cases. It's not quite clear that a PCR positive and a serology positive combination still means that the person has recovered from a recent infection or not. You can imagine someone who might have been infected a year ago or late last year, who would therefore be serology positive because of the previous infection. That person could have a reinfection now and therefore be active now to that reinfection, but they would test positive in both tests. So this has until now really been a kind of like an academic like thought experiment rather than real life practice. So what this reinfection case tells us is two things. One, that yes, it's important that we assess how we interpret the combination of serology positive and a PCR positive in the light of the fact that it could now be reinfection cases. I don't know what the answer to that is, but it's something that we should be thinking about now. The second is it shows the importance of continued vigilance and the safe management measures that we have in place in order to keep control of epidemics as they happen in the community, because we will get some more cases like this cluster, and it's important we can deal with it.
Professor, from Thursday, all travellers from India must serve an additional 7-day stay-home notice at their place of residence after they quarantine for 14 days at a dedicated facility.
Singapore will also allow entry and transit for those with recent travel history to South Africa and the UK, but they'll be subjected to an extra 7-day SHN period at their place of residence as well.
So, Professor, what do you make of the stricter border controls? Sufficient, or should borders be temporarily closed to travellers coming in from India?
The situation in India is quite worrying. The epidemic wave that they're experiencing just now is bigger than the first wave, and it seems to be still in this exponential growth phase. So because of that, on a per capita basis, there's quite a lot of risk for an individual traveller coming over from India to Singapore. On top of that, there's quite large flows of travellers from India to Singapore. So we're kind of like at these two different levels of risk. We've got per capita risk is quite high, so there's a high probability of an individual passenger being infected, but also there's quite a large number of passengers. So because of that, I think it does make sense that we think about tightening up the border to India. There's, I guess, two main ways we can do that. One is to make quarantine a little bit more onerous, so increasing the length to 3 weeks rather than 2 weeks. The other is to reduce the number of travelers coming into the country from India. So I think that we'll be looking at using a combination of both of these in order to keep the risk to Singapore at a maintained level.
So Prof, you know, while we are tightening border restrictions for travelers from India, the SHN period for travelers from Hong Kong will be reduced from 14 days to 7 days at their place of residence. But considering the virus's incubation period can be up to 14 days, are we risking leakage into the community?
Well, the border control is never going to be 100% effective. There's two different approaches that countries can take to border controls. One is that they could aim to try to get to zero community transmission and then to close off the border, to keep it a very strict amount of border control. This is the kind of approach that places like New Zealand or Taiwan have taken in the past. Another approach, which is the approach that Singapore has taken, is not to try to get to zero local cases, but to get to low local cases. And that is complemented then by a border measure which doesn't need to be 100% effective. We can tolerate a little bit of missed spillover infections into the community because we know that we've got enough safe management measures in place that we'll be able to control those. So switching from 14 to 7 days for the quarantine from Hong Kong, it slightly increases the risk, but the risk is already very low for travelers coming from Hong Kong into Singapore anyway. So I think that is quite a tolerable increase in risk. The other thing that I think is important to remember is that Hong Kong and Singapore are quite similar cities. The prevalence and the incidence of COVID in the two places is at quite similar levels. Therefore, someone traveling from Hong Kong to Singapore doesn't really increase the risk to Singapore. And similarly, someone, a traveler from Singapore into Hong Kong, doesn't increase the risk of spread within Hong Kong. So I think that given that, the change to slightly more relaxed measures for Hong Kong, given the epidemic situation they've got in Hong Kong at present, that actually seems to be quite a sensible approach. And it's one that I support.
Thanks for setting aside time to speak with us, Professor. We've been speaking with Associate Professor Alex Cook from the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health at NUS.